Hey, this is Pastor Matt from Missio Dei Fellowship in Elk Creek, Wisconsin. I'm thankful that you found our sermons, and I hope that they're a way to encourage you in your walk with Christ. However, this sermon was given in the context of my local church and for those that God has entrusted to me. If you are in our area, I want to encourage you to come on a Sunday to worship with our body. And if you're not in this area, these sermons are a great tool for supplementing your walk with Christ, but no means a substitute for your local church. You need to submit yourself to a faithful Bible-teaching church and shepherd in your area. I would ask you to open up your Bibles to Luke chapter 5. In fact, I'd look it up. I told the earlier service this, but the last time we were in the Gospel of Luke was December 15th. And so it's been a while, but we once again return this morning to this most profound portrait of Jesus Christ. For those of you who are a bit newer with us and haven't necessarily been with us through the Gospel of Luke, it is important to first understand what Luke is. That is why he's writing and what his purposes are with his gospel. And so Luke chapter 1, in fact, if you want to turn there quickly, you can. In Luke chapter 1 in verses 1 through 4, he very clearly lays out his intent for us. Now, I've already dealt with that in detail when we began the gospel, and so you can go back and listen to my first sermon on this series and get a fuller version of what this is all about if you want to go back and listen. But in verses 1 through 4, we learn that Luke, who of course is the author here, is seeking to compile a historical account or a formal record concerning the person and the work of Jesus Christ, of his words and his work. And so this is historical biography. And so in verse 2 in chapter 1, he states that he has received his information, notice, from the hand of many eyewitnesses. And then in verse 3, he states that he has investigated everything carefully from the beginning and then is now seeking to write it in consecutive order. And so this is his method. This is his approach to his work of history. And so why? Why is he doing this? Well, notice verse 4, well, so that, and here's the purpose, so that you may know, and that's important, that you may know, so this is an intellectual thing, but so that you may know the exact truth about the things which you've been taught. So this is not introductory stuff, this gospel. This is a record of what you've been taught. And so if you were to compare the writing of Luke with some of his contemporary secular historians there in the first century, you'd actually find that Luke writes with a tremendously high caliber. In fact, as we've been going along here, if you've been with us, you may have noticed actually zero comment from Luke as a, I guess, what we would call a biased observer. You've seen zero emotion. You've seen zero personal commentary from Luke. Rather, he simply records the facts. He records them with extreme objectivity. And so he is writing in a manner consistent with first century formal history. He wants us to know the truth. He wants us to have a written account of what actually happened concerning this man, Jesus Christ, and on the basis of credible testimony. And so there's no doubt that his history would have been examined and even tested by fellow historians and fellow scholars of his day there in the first century. No doubt his record would have been closely scrutinized from the witnesses that he interviewed and the records from which he drew his information. And so this is, again, a very high-level work that he sought to undertake. And of course, it's a two-volume work, the book of Acts being his second volume to his history. And so when you approach the Gospel of Luke, and for that matter, the book of Acts, it is important to keep in mind what Luke is trying to do. And that is that he is seeking to build for us a formidable history of the events surrounding Jesus Christ. And so as we began working through the Gospel, it's no wonder then why we encounter these various testimonies of Jesus. In fact, we've seen various figures, various characters who have stood as witness to these events and these words of Jesus Christ and as personally present testimonies. And so again, you can go back and listen to some of those sermons if you'd like, but just understand that the first three or four chapters here of Luke are an extended introduction that no other gospel possesses. This is unique to Luke. He is highly concerned with giving a reliable record in a formal history that, again, was based on eyewitness testimony that could be examined and even tested by those who were still alive in his day. And again, he wanted to make certain that which recorded was true and accurate and reliable and without embellished speculation. And so Luke Acts is a very unique body of work within the writings of Holy Scripture. And then on top of that, we know as well that it is divinely inspired. And so from a Christian perspective, at least, when you take a step back and bring these two components together, namely the fact that it's a historical record, but also that it's a divinely inspired account, what you end up having then is the written record of God himself. This is his testimony. This is his witness to you concerning his son, Jesus Christ. And so this has been a fascinating and I would say formative study, at least for me, over the past year and a half. And so this morning we continue on and we're going to pick it up in chapter 5 in verses 12 through 16 with this somewhat well-known story of Jesus healing this man who was full of leprosy, as Luke records. And so it is an account that reveals for us not only the compassion in the heart of Jesus as the great physician, but it's also a telling description of how it is then that all of us must come to this man, Jesus. And so again, chapter 5 and verse 12. And please follow along as I read these verses, just five verses, recorded under the inspiration of the Spirit by Luke, who is a theologian, pastor, historian, and physician. He writes, "While he," that is Jesus, "was in one of the cities, behold, there was a man covered or full of leprosy. And when he saw Jesus, he fell on his face and implored him, saying, 'Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean.' And he stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, 'I am willing, be cleansed.' And immediately the leprosy left him. And he ordered him to tell no one, but to go and show yourself to the priest and make an offering for your cleansing, just as Moses commanded as a testimony to them. But the news about him was spreading even farther, and large crowds were gathering to hear him and be healed of their sicknesses. But Jesus himself would often slip away to the wilderness and pray." Well, again, just five short verses here, not a lot of complexity, not a lot of mystery, relatively straightforward. And so notice again how it begins, verse 12. Luke states, "Now, while he was in one of the cities..." Now remember, he's just gathered his first disciples. We saw that in verses 1 through 11. He hasn't yet gathered all of his disciples. That's still to come, but he's gathered at least two of them. And so they're now watching him, and everything that he does is they travel with him and follow him on his journeys. But having gathered then some of his disciples, notice he's now going from city to city and to minister to the people. But the primary function of his ministry, as we've been seeing, is that of, and as I pointed out for you, is that of preaching. In fact, notice down in chapter 4 and verse 43, it says, "But he," that is Jesus, "said to them, 'I must preach the kingdom of God to the other cities also.' And why? Well, for I was sent for this purpose." Verse 44, "So he kept on preaching in the synagogues of Judea." And so preaching was the primary purpose of his ministry. It was the primary feature of his ministry. He came with news. He came with a message to declare. And again, the content of that message was the idea of the kingdom of God. Again, chapter 4, verse 43, "I must preach the kingdom of God to the other cities also." And so, of course, Matt's going to continue to develop that for us. But here he is going from city to city, declaring the kingdom. And yet accompanying his ministry are from time to time these rather miraculous events, these miracles, these healings. And they are events which serve to confirm his message as a messenger. And so Jesus is preaching about the kingdom. His message is coming in power. It's coming with the witness of these miracles, these extraordinary events. And yet in so doing, the miracles themselves are declaring to us the nature of what the kingdom is to be, of what the kingdom is going to look like. And so as he begins to heal people, as we're going to see here this morning, there is a very important theological message behind these healings. And so again, while he is in one of the cities, as Luke records, which... again, he's in the Galilee, as it's called, that northern part of Israel, which is near the Sea of Galilee. Luke states there was a man full of leprosy. Now, just a word about leprosy, and I assume that many of you, if you've been in church any length of time, know something of leprosy, but I'm obviously going to be drawing on this from the work of others. But we get the term of leprosy from the Greek lepros, which means something along the lines of scaly or scale. It is a very general sort of catch-all term that can be used to designate actually a myriad of skin conditions and a myriad of skin diseases, and all of which fall under this clinical category of leprosy. In the Hebrew, the Old Testament term actually functioned as the exact same thing. It's this idea of scale or scaly, and was used as a basic description, though, of the symptoms. Now, this might be a little bit more than you're looking for, but as you're aware by now, you kind of just get the product of what we find interesting. And so just bear with me, I'm moving somewhere with this, but the discussion on the pathology of leprosy is rather wide and varied, especially when it comes to what the term would have meant for the days of Israel. And so nothing in Scripture actually describes the disease in terms of its pathology, that is, its origin and the development of the disease and exactly what leprosy is, sort of scientifically or clinically. And so it's more or less described in the Scriptures simply by its symptoms, which, again, is why it's given the name of leprosy, of scale or scaly. And so as I'd assume that most of you know, the disease would surface itself on the skin, and so it'd be this sort of severe form of skin disease. Most medical historians believe the disease to be very old, likely originating somewhere in Egypt, as many tests have been performed on the cadavers of ancient Egyptian mummies. And so since the Egyptians were so well preserved, these medical scientists have been able to extract fragments of this ancient bacilli, which is basically ancient bacteria. And what they've determined is that this bacilli is very close to what we would label today as sort of modern-day Hansen's disease, which is what we identify today as leprosy. And so in that sense, it's a very ancient disease. In fact, it goes as far back as the times of Elisha in the Old Testament. In fact, we just saw that in Luke chapter 4. And so it is a very old disease. Now, as you know, there's actually two whole chapters devoted to leprosy in Leviticus chapters 13 and 14, which, of course, outline the prescriptions and the diagnosis of leprosy, as well as all the laws of purification and the sacrifices for leprosy. And so it was a very, very major issue in the Old Testament. In fact, it was something for which God established severe and strict laws for. It was something that therefore created an immense amount of social as well as psychological stigma. And so the priests, who were basically the official medical examiners in the theocratic kingdom, were responsible, again, based on Leviticus chapters 13 and 14, for performing these examinations. And so as a person was suspected to have the disease, they were then required to present themselves to this priest, and then they were required to undergo a very thorough examination. Again, you can read the prescriptions for that in Leviticus chapter 13. But should a person be found to indeed possess the disease, they were then officially declared by law to be unclean. And so with that, of course, were some tremendous social stigmas. In fact, you were in a very real sense considered defiled. You were considered to be ceremonially corrupt. In fact, in many ways, you were no longer considered to be part of the nation until you were freed, if you were freed at all from the disease. If then you were one of the lucky ones who was somehow able to recover, and that typically only took place with minor cases, you then had to be purified and then ceremonially cleansed. Beyond that, you need to then offer the prescribed sacrifices, again, all of which are outlined in the book of Leviticus. You then need to be prayed over, and then you'd need to be formally reintroduced back into the social infrastructure of the nation. And so there were many psychological but also sociological effects to a person who had to deal with this disease. In fact, so much so that God had to put into law for how to then appropriately reintroduce a person back into society, lest they live the rest of their days with a sort of asterisk next to their name. And so there were definite psychological and sociological and political and religious stigmas to the disease, as many had thought that leprosy was the result of some kind of personal sin or perhaps even generational sin that was passed along through your family. And so it was a disease at times that would be uniquely devastating to a person. It would strip them of all that they knew and loved and then coat them in the eyes of the people in some tremendous shame. In fact, in Leviticus chapter 13 and verses 45 and 46, we see the nature of that shame. And so the law states that as for the leper who has the infection, his clothes shall be torn And the hair on his head shall be uncovered, and he shall cover his mustache and cry out, unclean, unclean. And so they are to yell everywhere they go with hands in the air, unclean. They are to ward off any unsuspecting people who may not know that they're there. Verse 46, he shall remain unclean all the days during which he has the infection. He is unclean. And he shall live alone, and his dwelling shall be outside the camp. And so you are stripped of family, you are stripped of friends, you are stripped of your job, you are stripped of all social prestige, which in an honor and shame culture was a massive deal. You were cut off from making an offering, cut off from the sacrifices, cut off from the entire religious institution. And so you were cut off from having any kind of ability, and think about this one, any kind of ability to now sacrifice or atone for your sin. And so not only are you separated from the people, but you are separated now from God himself. And so again, psychologically and especially sociologically here, this is a very difficult thing to deal with. This is very difficult. And yet perhaps the most difficult at a personal level was the physical component. In fact, the Mycobacterium lepra is, I think, somewhat of a, I guess, fascinating disease, and it's essentially entirely curable today, which is pretty amazing if you think about it. But it's a disease, as many of you know, that actually attacks the nerves. In ancient times, of course, they did not know this, and so they thought that it was a contagion that essentially attacked the surface elements of a person's body. In fact, it appeared to just eat away at the extremities of a person as the eyes and the ears and the nose of lepers would begin to virtually disintegrate. And infected holes would begin to break out all over the body, and especially beginning with the person's head. And so from all external perspectives, this was a surface disease. It was something that began on the outside and then began to eat itself inward, or so they thought. And so it began with a patch on the face, usually a white or pink patch on the brow or somewhere on the face, and then begin to spread to the rest of the head, usually making its way to the larynx, which is why it would often affect the voice and the speech of a person. It then develop into a spongy, almost tumorous swelling that would then spread to the rest of the face, causing a person at times such disfiguration that they'd begin to look like a lion, which is why actually at times it's sometimes referred to as lion's disease. And then from there, it was understood to attack the rest of the body and the extremities, moving ultimately internally, attacking the organs and the systemic functions of the body, which of course would lead to the victim's inevitable death. And so in ancient times, this is what they thought. They thought that this was an external disease that would move inward. But the reality, as we know today, is that it's actually the exact opposite. This is an internal disease affecting primarily the nerves of the body, and then the symptoms of which externally evidence themselves, but through a kind of self-infliction. And so it's essentially an anesthetic disease. Again, it attacks the nerves, and so it eliminates a person's ability to feel pain. In fact, it attacks just about every part of the body, including even the nerve endings of the teeth, which a person would just destroy their teeth, of course, creating all kinds of infections in the gum, which would then move to the face. And so just a devastating disease in many ways, as a person is essentially destroying themselves, but through their inability to feel. In fact, in an article interviewing a man by the name of Dr. Paul Brand, who's essentially done his life's work and research in the field of leprosy, I think I have the link for his website in your notes. It's a fascinating website, and I'd commend it to you. But it states this. It says, in the villages of Africa and Asia, a person with leprosy has been known to reach directly into a charcoal fire to retrieve a dropped potato. Nothing in his body told him not to. Patients at Brand Hospital, which is his hospital there in India, work all day gripping a shovel with a protruding nail and never feel the nail tearing their flesh. They extinguish a burning wick with their bare hands. They do it all the time because they can't feel it. They walk on splintered glass or anything and everything else. They feel nothing. Dr. Brand began formulating his somewhat radical theory originally that Hansen's disease was chiefly anesthetic and therefore only indirectly a destroyer. On one occasion, he recounts of a man trying to open a door to a storeroom in the place in India, but it had a rusty padlock and it wouldn't respond to the key. A patient, he says, an undersized, malnourished 10-year-old would approach him smiling, saying, "Let me." He offered and reached for the key, and with a quick jerk of his hand, he turned the key in the lock, and Brand was dumbfounded. How could this weak youngster out-exert him? Well, his eyes caught a telltale clue. Was that blood on the floor? Upon examining the boy's finger, Brand discovered the act of turning the key had gnashed a finger open to the bone. Skin, fat, and joint were all exposed, yet the boy was completely unaware of it. To him, the sensation of cutting his finger to the bone was no different from picking up a stone or turning a coin in his pocket. The daily routine of life literally ground away as the patient's hands and feet, and no warning system ever alerted them. If an ankle is turned, tearing tendon and muscle, they would simply adjust and walk crooked. If a rat chewed off a finger in the night, they wouldn't discover it until it was missing in the morning. And so this is leprosy. This is the effects of what we know to be leprosy. Now, there is essentially full cures for this today, which again is pretty amazing. But again, the point to understand is that this is an internal disease. This is an internal disease and that attacks the warning system of the body and therefore numbs a person, completely numbs a person to the self-destructive habits which lead to death. And so in almost all the fatal cases of the disease, death was the result, and usually every single time, but due to self-infliction and a kind of self-destructive behavior. In other words, and depending on the situation, either long-term or even very swiftly and short-term, but the result of this internal disease was nothing short of the killing of self. And so when you take a step back and you think about it, what is this? What is this? What does this disease almost perfectly mimic? Well, I'd say that it's a pretty good picture of sin. An internal disease that attacks the inside of a person, but then works its way out, and even at the ignorance of the carrier, to which it then in turn destroys the person, but through self-inflicted practices that lead to death. In fact, I'd say that's a very good description of sin. And the very reason, therefore, for why this, I think, becomes such a powerful account here in the ministry of Jesus. This is a disease which not only leads to death, but listen, completely marginalizes a person from the person and the blessings of God. And so this is a physical account, but that depicts a very significant spiritual reality. And so while sin's got this ability to manifest itself in varying degrees within the life of people, we know this, where some people are so destructive and so self-inflicting that their life is in literal ruins from poor decisions and poor actions and a life laced with tremendous folly where they can't seem to find wisdom for some reason in any capacity. And everyone around them sees it. Everyone around them knows it. For some reason, they can't. And so every area of their life is in shambles, from family to work to friends to how they spend their money. And yet they live in a kind of self-denial and completely ignorant to the reality of what's truly going on. And because they think that the problem is somehow outside of them. There are people like this. And so in some cases, this internal disease of sin has so externally manifested itself that it becomes obvious to everybody around them. But then you've got others who not so much. Not so much, at least on the surface. Sin has evidenced itself in other ways, ways perhaps not so external, not so public. And yet none of that actually nullifies the presence of the disease. And so the passage before us this morning is an account that points to something far more serious and significant than disease. And so let me just say that the physical disease here is not the issue of the passage. It is not the issue of the passage. And we're going to see that in a very explicit way with this healing of the paralytic next time. But just understand that we have come now to a section in which we're now beginning to be introduced to the entire reason for why Jesus has even come. Which, of course, is to make those who are spiritually sick well. He has come to make them well. And so this is the account of a diseased human. Completely desperate, completely hopeless, completely dependent on the ability of another to purify him from that which will bring him death, from that which internally plagues his entire being. And so what he requires now is a healing that begins on the inside. In fact, notice how severe his case truly is. Verse 12, Luke states it was a man, and notice the qualifier here, but there was a man full of leprosy. And so Luke, of course, being the physician that he is, includes this qualifier here that no other gospel writer includes when they're giving this account in their gospel. But this was a man full, pleres, full of leprosy. Now this disease, make no mistake, was the modern day equivalent to cancer. It was regarded as utterly incurable. And so notice, Luke records here as a physician that he is now, this man is now full of this disease. And so in a very graphic sense, his body is riddled. This is utter hopelessness for this man. In fact, this would have been a very advanced and progressed stage of this disease. And so the qualifier is very important because it helps us understand just the level of desperation that this man would have had. This was severe. Notice, the man wasn't with leprosy, but he was a man full of leprosy. In other words, this was a man with zero hope. This is hopelessness, zero hope. In fact, his days of hoping and praying and perhaps even waiting for a potential cure have far passed by now. This is not a matter of if the disease is going to take him, but of when. And so again, just be thinking about this in terms of sin. The wages of sin is what? Death. The result is death. In fact, this is why the death rate is 100% for all human beings, right? All have sinned, according to Romans chapter 3, all have sinned and therefore fall short of God's perfect standard of righteousness. And so all of us live in a veritable state of being perpetually filled with the reality of this disease, of this sin. And so it is not a matter for us if death will come for us, but of when. And we know this. And so this is a man full of leprosy. This is a very progressive stage. And so what I want to point out for us, and it's actually the entire reason for why Luke includes it here in his gospel, but what's important for us to notice is not necessarily the miracle itself, but rather what precedes this miracle. And so just notice the posture of, and this is what I want us to notice, notice the posture of this man. Notice the disposition of this desperately diseased leper and sinner in light of seeing Jesus Christ. This is what's important. This is what is significant, that in light of seeing who Jesus is and having heard of his report and his claims and his miracles, notice how this man comes to him. And so number one, notice, but he comes with a posture that is very, very desperate. He comes as a very desperate man. He doesn't come debating the disease. He doesn't come questioning Jesus' ability. Doesn't come wanting to have a conversation or to vet Jesus to see if what he says truly lines up with his worldview. Rather, notice he comes in complete and total and absolute desperation. And that is the key component, zero hope. This man has no argument. He has no plea. He's got zero negotiations as to why perhaps he doesn't deserve this disease and that it's a mistake. Doesn't talk about the injustice of God or that God isn't acting fair toward him and that some worse sinner should have possessed the disease. Rather, this is a very dramatic moment. In fact, this isn't merely inappropriate behavior on the part of the leper, but this is forbidden behavior. Again, according to Levitical law, which of course shows, again, just the desperation of this man. In fact, by the time of Jesus, contact with the leper was so taboo that we actually have records of lepers being completely forbidden to enter the walls of Jerusalem. And so this is a big deal here, what this leper does. In fact, fear of the contagion in this day was so high that outside the walls of Jerusalem, lepers were forbidden to come within 6 feet of a well person, and then 100 feet if they were downwind. In fact, one rabbi records that he couldn't even eat an egg because it was bought on the street that a leper walked down. This is like corona fear. And so not only did Levitical law forbid certain behaviors, but even by the time of Jesus, there was such socialist stigma attached to leprosy that zero sympathy existed. There was no sympathy for these people. There were zero social programs set up for the leper. Rather, your entire job was to work hard at keeping your distance. And if they kept their distance, then you weren't forced to throw stones, literally. And so what this man does here is not merely inappropriate, but actually legally and even socially forbidden, essentially. Which again, just goes to communicate the level of his desperation. He throws off the law, he throws off social prestige, which by this point is completely non-existent for this man. And so he is very much past the stage of fear and denial that he possesses this disease. And yet at the sight of Jesus, notice, he comes. He comes. He understands his position. He understands his state. Now, how does he come? And again, this is what's important, but how does he approach this one whom he believes possesses the authority and the ability to make him well? Well, again, number one, he comes desperate, but then number two, notice he comes in worship. Again, verse 12. Comes in worship. In fact, the phrase here that he falls down on his face is a construction that's used all throughout the New Testament, but exclusively in reference to worship. So this is an act of worship. This is an act of bowing down before Jesus. In fact, notice it's used in conjunction with the term here of Lord. He says, "And Lord, if you are willing, you can make me well." And so he addresses him as Lord. Now, it could just be a term of respect, which is how the term Lord is sometimes used in the scriptures, but that wouldn't at all fit the context. Because notice, again, he bows down. He virtually prostrates himself. Literally, he falls on his face. Now, whether or not he knew Jesus to be the Son of God, the text doesn't actually say, but this is without question worship. This is reverence for recognizing that there was something worthy of worship in this man, Jesus. And so he comes desperate, he comes in reverent worship, and then third, notice he comes with immediate haste and urgency. Comes with haste and urgency, and so he understands that in light of the disease, that his time has grown unbelievably short. This is not a time to just intellectually consider Jesus, or maybe consider him when you get around to it. That is not how you come to him. You don't see the person of Christ, you don't hear the gospel preached, and then worry about it later. Rather, the illustration here bespeaks to the fact that the only appropriate response to seeing or the hearing of Jesus is urgency. Time is short, and you are, as a sinner, listen, in the throes of death, and you know this. You come immediately, you come in haste. Desperate circumstances require very desperate responses, and so at the recognition of what we are before the sight of Jesus requires an immediate response. And especially because tomorrow is not promised. Tomorrow is not promised to you. And yet how often do we assume that it is? And so we'll worry about our sin, we'll wrestle with the issue of Jesus at some other point in our life, but the truth of the world is that some other point is not promised. It is not promised. And so that's perfectly illustrated here with the fact that this leper comes, notice, with incredible haste. He throws himself at the feet of Jesus. And then fourth, notice he comes in humility. Comes in humility. He says, "And Lord, if you are willing, you can make me well." And so he understands exactly what Jesus can do at this point. In fact, this is a third class conditional. And so it just means that the entire focus is on the desire of Jesus, which means that his ability is not at all what's in question. Rather, his only concern is the willingness of Jesus. And yet notice, in light of understanding what Jesus can do for him, he does not presume. He does not presume upon the grace of Jesus Christ. And so he's evidently heard of Jesus. He knows his reputation. He's heard of what he can do. He's perhaps seen the results of his healings in the life of others. And yet notice, as he comes before the Lord of the universe and as but a mere leper and mere sinner and knowing what Jesus can do for him, he does not presume, does not make demands as if something is owed to him. And so let me just say that one of the first steps in being forgiven is by first understanding that God does not owe you forgiveness. He does not owe you forgiveness. He owes no one forgiveness. In fact, if he owed you forgiveness, then grace would cease to be grace, would it not? Grace is undeserved. Grace is unearned. So to presume that God owes you something is the height of folly. And so while God owes nothing, he does promise, right? He does promise, and he is always faithful to his promises. He promises to forgive. He promises a full pardon of your sin. But listen, it requires that you first come to him in a very specific way. In a very specific way, and that is that we come in humility, presuming nothing. He is not obligated to the sinner. He is obligated to his promises. And he is always faithful to those promises. In fact, notice the man here comes intimately aware of his wretchedness, comes keenly aware, perhaps, his repulsiveness before this one who does not possess the disease, comes broken in spirit, contrite of heart, bankrupt in terms of anything that he can offer. And so if Jesus were to heal this man, it'd be nothing but undeserved and unearned favor. The only thing that he has to offer is what? The stench of his disease, literally. And so if Jesus were to heal, then it'd be from the center of his own sovereign compassion to heal this one who does not deserve, though desperate he may be. And then finally, notice he comes in faith. Comes in faith. He says, "And Jesus, if you are willing, then you can make me clean." And so he throws himself at the feet of Jesus. This is faith, plain and simple. This is a desperate trust in the one who's got the ability to make even the most defiled person completely pure. He can make him clean. He can make him whole again. So this man comes in desperation, comes in worship, comes immediately, comes in humility, and he comes believing that Jesus Christ can and does make the vilest of wretch completely pure. So just unbelievably instructive for how it is that all sinners are required to come to him. This is how we come, and not just once, but day after day as we continually cast ourselves upon this one who has the ability and possesses all authority to make us well, to make us pure before the eyes of a holy God. And yet I know that in light of that, and in light of the weight of sin and the gravity that some people feel perhaps at times at the reality of what they've done in their life, and even wrestle at times, honestly wrestle if this can truly apply to them, and because they know their past, they are intimately aware of their past, perhaps aware of what they did even last night. Just notice the response of Jesus to this man, to the question of this man. For those who doubt, those who waver, notice the response of Jesus to the question of this one who here is functioning in this account as the symbol for even the vilest of sinner. Verse 13, notice, Jesus immediately stretches out his hand. He touches him and says what? He says, "I am willing. Be cleansed." Be cleansed. Divine pronouncement, divine declaration of authority, but over his disease. So let me just say that if you think that if you're somehow past the offer of grace, if you think that your sin, even for those of you who are Christians and keep finding yourself falling back into that sin that so easily entangles and so easily causes you to stumble, and you start to get to that point where you wonder if you've ever out-sinned the grace of God in your life, if you're wondering if he's still willing to offer forgiveness for your sin in the face of your constant day after day failings and sometimes overt rejection, and the entire point of the account is to pronounce to you, listen, that he is willing. He's always willing to cleanse you. In fact, he is not like you or me. And this is such great news. He's not like you or me, where when people cross our arbitrary line, they essentially overstep our grace, right? And it is a very thin line. In fact, our inability to forgive even the least of offenders just goes to show how much like God we aren't. And he is always willing. being the infinite God of the universe, his grace is infinitely indispensable. And he has no line. He has no line. You cannot out-sin his forgiveness. If you are his, can't do it. Can't do it. And so the question becomes, so are you his? Are you truly his? Well, notice there is a condition to becoming his. There is a condition. Notice the one provision that God has is illustrated here, and that is that you, listen, must come to him. You must come to him. And you must keep coming to him. And how? Desperately, worshipfully, immediately, in humility, and in faith. Just like this diseased leper, this is how we must come to him. And yet as you do, there will always remain for you the very willing purification for your sin. He will purify you. He does forgive. He does pardon all of our iniquities. And then notice it's upon Jesus touching him that he's now made clean. He's actually made clean. In other words, what did the leper do to be made clean? Well, absolutely nothing, right? He did nothing. This was all the work exclusively of Jesus Christ alone. All that this leper did was simply come to him, contributing nothing but his disease. And yet in his coming, the willingness of Jesus has made him clean. It is the will of Jesus that makes you clean. This is his desire. The point to understand is that if you come to him, then what's absolutely required is that you bring the absolute fullness of your sin with you. You must bring your sin. In fact, if you don't bring your sin, then what is there to heal? What is there to make well? You must come with all of your sin, confessing, admitting, acknowledging the state of your disease before this one who does not possess it. And when you do that as a desperate sinner, he will forgive you. Not because he's obligated to you, but because he is obligated to himself. And he has made a profound promise. And his promise is to purify you. Now, of course, at this point, some will ask the question of the text of how it is that Jesus can be considered to have fully kept and obeyed the law if he has just seemingly broke the law. Leviticus 13 and 14 are very clear that it is utterly forbidden to even touch a leper. And so how can Jesus have perfectly fulfilled that law if he's just now seemingly broke it? Well, this is where the term immediately, notice, end of verse 13, becomes very important. In fact, it functions, but as if to say that in the moment, and that's a very important qualifier there, but in the moment that Jesus touches this leper, then he is no longer touching a leper. Rather, he is touching one who in that very same moment was clean. And so it's from the authority of his word, notice, that he commands him clean. And yet in that very moment, he is not in fact actually touching a leper and therefore breaking the law, but rather now he is touching one who is completely clean. And again, because it's from the authority of his word that has made this man clean. In fact, Jesus could have very easily commanded him clean and then not touched him, right? He could have done that. But he very intentionally does touch him. And then in so doing, notice, reveals for us, this is the point, that not only was the leper healed, but it shows the fullness of his cleansing. And so his touch, in a very real sense, confirms the work of his word. And that's the point to understand. But then beyond that, I'd also say that the touch here shows the compassion of Jesus. Shows the compassion of Jesus as now a fellow man, a fellow human, who can now sympathize with his brethren. And all things can sympathize with his creation in a very intimate way. And we're going to see this all throughout the gospel, just how important touch actually is to Jesus and how important it is to effective ministry. We're going to see that he often touches those whom he heals, those whom he encounters, the most diseased, the most sick. Shows his love, shows his compassion, shows his care, shows his willingness to enter even the worst of circumstances of these needy people. And so touch is very important to effective ministry. And then in verse 14, notice the scene all of a sudden just shifts here as Jesus now commands this man to tell no one. It's a very strange thing, just considering Jesus' entire point was to declare exactly who he was and what he's come to do. And yet notice he orders him here to tell no one, verse 14, but instead he says, go and show yourself to the priest and make an offering for your cleansing, just as Moses or the Old Testament law commanded. Now, this is a very important detail because it's showing exactly who Jesus is. In fact, it's revealing a number of things about him. It's revealing three things in particular. And so notice number one shows that Jesus in no way has come to abolish the law or to usurp the law, but to indeed fulfill the law. And so notice he exhorts the man here to fulfill the obligations of God's law, which again was a law that stated you must go, you must present yourself, you must enter those rites of purification, and you must make a sacrifice. And so if you were to be examined by the priest and found to be clean, you'd then need to make that offering before you could formally re-enter society. And so this is what Jesus commands him to do. He says, go fulfill the law of Moses, but then in so doing, it shows that he has not come to usurp that law, but to fulfill that law. And so number one, it reveals to us, first and foremost, Jesus' perspective of the law. Very important. And we're going to develop that as we go along in the gospel. But then second, by having this man do this, it would then show that Jesus' healing was in fact credible, but at a legal level. It would show that his healing was credible at a legal level. In fact, if the leper were to just go and announce this news to people and tell his friends and tell his family without first being cleared by the priest and the law, then there'd be no formal reason for anyone to believe his words. Now, they might see a physical difference in the man, but that would actually carry very little weight to the Jewish mind. And so if the man goes and receives first this formal bill of a clean health, so to speak, then as the man begins to now tell his family and his friends and the people around him, and especially that Jesus is the one who has healed him, then all of a sudden Jesus has the formal witness of the law to confirm his work. And so for this reason, Jesus as well commands the man to first fulfill the obligations of the law. But perhaps more important than any of those, and again, it's why I think that he includes it here in the account, but it's the fact that his work reveals himself, but in contrast to the law. His miracle reveals the work of Jesus, but in contrast to the law. And this is actually very important because remember, in this healing section here, and we're going to see this more starting next time with the paralytic, but the miracles of Jesus are going to be tightly connected always to the authority and his ability to forgive sin. And so just think about it. If a person were to contract leprosy and then come down with the disease in whatever capacity, well, the reality is that he could go to the priest in the temple all that he wanted, and he can go make all the sacrifices of all the animals that he wanted, but in going to the priest, there would be absolutely zero purification. That would bring zero healing. There was no special prayer, no special work. There was no special sacrifice that a priest could offer that would somehow bring forth a supernatural healing. And so there was no ordinance or command or even promise in the Old Testament law that if obeyed would somehow cleanse the leper of his disease. You will find that nowhere in the law. And so why? Why is that the case? Well, because the function of the law, remember, which is why a priest had to examine, but the function of the law was to simply reveal the reality of what was present. That's the purpose of the law. And so all that the law could do or ever do is simply reveal the state of the disease. And so all that a priest could do by the authority of the law was either declare you clean or unclean. But listen, it had zero power to make you clean. The law could not purify you. And that is the significance of why Jesus does this. Listen, there is a holy law of God, and we know this. There's a holy law of God. And that law demands before a holy God absolute perfection. The law is God's holy standard by which he judges and examines every aspect of a person's thought and character and deed and motive. And yet the scriptures are abundantly clear that before this law, the only verdict that it will ever find in any person is guilt. And yet there is nothing within that law that can make you clean. No amount of works, no amount of sacrifice, no amount of religious activity, no amount of prayer. Rather, the function of the law is to examine you. The purpose of the law is to expose that which is present in you. And so what's critical to understand is that as every single one of us are scanned and placed under the examination of this law, the only verdict it finds is guilt. And so we are, to keep in theme with the passage, completely riddled. We are completely riddled. Or to use the term here in verse 12, we are full with this disease, sin. And that is what the law reveals about your life every single time. Romans chapter 5 and verse 20, the law came in, and why? Well, so that, and so here's the purpose of the law, but so that transgression would increase. It's a very strange statement. So the law came in with the result of increased transgression. Now, is that to say that if there was no law, then there'd be no sin? No. Rather, it's to say that where there is no law, there is no knowledge of sin. There is no knowledge of sin. And so the moment that the knowledge of the law comes about, it now exposes for a person what was already there in the first place. In fact, this is why Paul could say that I had no idea that I was a coveter until the law, what, told me not to covet. And then all I did was covet, all the time. And again, not because he didn't covet before, but now he's just aware of how much he did and does. And so at the presence of the law comes a knowledge of sin. There's an exposure. There is a full examination and a bringing to the light that which is present in you. And so Jesus here, knowing the purpose of the law is to examine the state of what is, commands this man, notice, he commands him to a full examination. To a full examination. And because as he does, it will reveal, listen, that which Jesus has done. Which is what? Full cleansing, purification, complete reversal of that which the law can only condemn. This is very significant. In the very beginning of Jesus' ministry here, he begins with a very powerful declaration. He begins with a work that shows that he has come not to abolish the law, but to in fact submit his work to this law. For an exam. And what does it do? Well, it reveals that he and he alone can purify. He can make a person clean from the findings of that law. In fact, this is a graphic illustration that looks forward to that which Jesus would accomplish on the cross. This is all hurling in a direction. That he has come to seek and to save the lost. That he has come to be that great physician of the soul. That he has come to reverse the effects of this deadly disease called sin. And so in the crosswork of Christ, he accomplishes what the law cannot accomplish. The entire point of this story is to declare that your hope for purification of your sin comes through one path and one path alone, and that is through the exclusive work of what Jesus Christ has done for you. This is about what Jesus has done for you on his cross, with his resurrection, and with his full obedience to the law. This is all about the work of Jesus. And yet I know that perhaps some of you, again, walk with that very heavy burden of guilt. Very heavy burden of awareness of your sin. You know what you've done. You know what you're like, especially when nobody's looking. On the other hand, perhaps some of you are self-righteous. Think you're doing pretty good. which just goes to show your sin. But some of you walk with a very heavy burden, and I know that. And you are, to use this illustration, very aware of the fullness of your sin every single day. But what God wants you to understand through the giving of this passage is that all of your guilt and disease and sin-riddled life can be made pure, can be cleansed completely, totally, without blemish, without spot. The only way that that sin can be forgiven is when you recognize, and this is the point, but when you recognize that you must come to him. You must come to him at some point in your life. You must come to him aware of your sin, bringing all of it with you, strapped to your back. And as you come, and with all of your sin on full display, which, by the way, is the only way that he'll receive you, you come desperate, you come worshiping, you come immediately, you come in humility, and you come believing. You must come believing that he has come to rescue you from your sin. And that's exactly why he's come. In fact, notice quickly, verses 15 and 16. Says, but the news about him was spreading even farther, and the large crowds were gathering to hear him, to be healed of their sicknesses. Verse 16, but, and this is the key word, but Jesus himself would often slip away to the wilderness and pray. Now, why do you think that is? Why do you think that is? If he has come to minister to the people, then why would he seek to slip away from opportunities to minister and to heal? Well, because he has not primarily come, and this is the point, but he has not primarily come to give us some kind of temporary healing. That is not why he's come. He has not come for a temporary fix. He has not come to solve a very temporary circumstance in your life. In other words, we saw from the day that he entered that temple as a 12-year-old boy, you'll have to think back to chapter 2, but from the day that he entered that temple, we saw that he was on that unflinching trajectory ultimately to go to the cross, right? This was his task. This is why he's come. And that is what every single healing account in this gospel is pointing to, ultimately. And so he pulls away to get with the Father, as he often did, but always in light of that great purpose for which he's come. Beyond the cross, in which he'd accomplish that final decisive work before the Father, in which he'd bring about a complete and full and everlasting healing. And so he'd pull away to reorient himself for that greater mission. He'd pray for strength and power, and we're going to see this, but he'd often remove himself from the light of that very temporary fame and temporary celebrity status that he possessed from doing such signs and wonders. And I think because he knew ultimately that a day was coming in which he'd have complete abandonment from such superficial fame. As he'd eventually go to that cross, betrayed by a nation, betrayed by those from within his most closest inner circle. But this is what the entire story points to. And so there's only one hope for the sinner. And that's all you need to understand this morning. There is only one means, one work through which the ridding of your disease of sin is accomplished, and it is through the exclusive cross work of Jesus Christ alone. The only one who can purify us. The only one who can make us clean from that which promises to kill us. That is our only hope, our one way to God. That which the law cannot do, Jesus has overwhelmingly accomplished. And so where the law finds you guilty, the beauty of this story is that Jesus sends us before that very same law, but to then receive that eternal declaration of clean. Possesses the power, possesses the ability. And so he beckons us to come to him. He is not a physician who's limited. He is not a physician who will turn you away. John 6:37, all that the Father gives to me will come to me, and the one coming to me I will in no way cast out. That is a promise to you. That is a promise that you ought to hold on to. He calls us to come. He calls us to gather at his feet, but with the full baggage of our sin. And we'll end here, but the greatest problem that you and I will ever face is the problem of sin and guilt before the law of God. That is our greatest problem. And yet as Jesus shows up here in the Gospel of Luke, he comes with power, he comes with purpose, comes with the only remedy to this great disease. And he is the only one capable of healing you. And so once you see your sickness, that is the prerequisite. You have to see your sin, as this man did. You have to understand the terminal state of your life. But as you do, the call of Jesus is to come. It's all you got to do. Just come to him, for he is willing and he is entirely able. He is. Let's pray. And so, Father, I do ask that this would happen. Pray for all in this room that we might be able to say that we know and believe and most certainly love the gospel of your Son. My hope and my prayer is that this word, which you have given to us in your providence this very morning, might not leave us unreflective, but that it might cause us by the power of your Spirit to better understand just the vastness of your love for sinners. That we might understand in a fuller, richer way of your compassion and your grace toward us. I pray for all here this morning that they might see just a little bit more the glorious reality of what it means that you, the God of all creation, has stooped. That you send forth your Son to take on flesh, take on the weakness of what it means to be a man, but so that you might enter our world and rescue us from the clutches of our own self-destruction. So may we come, may we bow down at the foot of your cross. May we find comfort in knowing that you are a God who loves to save sinners. And so I do ask that you would impress this truth upon us this morning. I ask that you'd establish it in our minds. You'd seal it within our hearts by the power of your Spirit. That we might have a hope, that we might find indeed a true rest finally by faith in you and you alone. And so I do ask these things for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.